This is podcast number 100 for the Well-Educated Mother's Heart. Hi, I'm Arlene Peterson, and today we're talking about James Oglethorpe and the settling of Georgia. I hope you've been inspired by the leadership examples of Henry Vane and William Penn, whose unselfishness, love, and faith played such a vital role in the planting of religious freedom, enjoyed by millions of people all over the world today. A freedom that we are, once again, at serious risk of losing if we're not vigilant. Today we touch upon the work of James Oglethorpe, the last of the trio of leaders I chose to spotlight this month. The sample story is taken from a 1905 text called Georgia History Stories by Joseph Harris Chapel, found in the high school section of the colonies. We'll pick up the story where it leads into how and why he colonizes Georgia. When the Turkish War was over, he returned to England and settled down to ways of peace. His father and elder brothers died, and he inherited the family estates. He was now a very rich man, but he lived a simple and sober life. He was elected to Parliament and served as a member for many years. While he was in Parliament, an event occurred that turned his attention toward America and caused him to become the founder of Georgia. This is how it happened. There was a cruel law in England at that time by which a person in debt might be thrown into prison by his creditors and kept there until his debts were somehow paid. Many poor, unfortunate people, innocent of any crime, languished in these debtors' prisons. Oglethorpe had a dear friend, a Mr. Robert Castell, who was a scholar and an artist. He wrote a fine book on architecture, which he illustrated with splendid pictures drawn by his own hand. He was so much taken up with writing the book that he neglected his business affairs, and when the book was published, instead of making money for him, it brought him heavily in debt, and he was condemned to be cast into the debtor's prison. In the prison to which he was assigned, smallpox was at the time raging, and he had never had the disease. He begged the prison keeper, a heartless wretch by the name of Bambridge, to let him lie in the common jail until the prison should be freed of the smallpox, or until his friends could arrange to pay his debts for him, which he was sure would be done in the course of a few months. Bambridge agreed to do so if Castell would pay him down in cash a certain sum of money as a bribe. But poor Castell had not the money, so he was thrown into the smallpox-infested prison, where he soon contracted the disease, and after a few days' suffering, he died an awful death, leaving his wife and little children poverty-stricken and helpless. When Oglethorpe heard of this outrage, his blood boiled with indignation. He at once introduced a bill into Parliament to have a committee appointed to examine the prisons of England and bring about a reform in their management. The bill was passed. Oglethorpe was made chairman of the committee, and with the other members, he spent several months visiting the prisons. He found in them many practices of shocking cruelty, all of which were immediately abolished. If Oglethorpe had done nothing more than bring about this reform, he would deserve the lasting gratitude of humanity. But he did not stop at this. While visiting the prisons, his sympathies were deeply aroused for the poor debtors whom he found languishing behind iron bars, though innocent of any crime. He determined to try to do something to help them out of their sad condition. By his earnest appeals, he got Parliament to pass a law by which they might be set free, provided they would agree to go to America and establish there for England a new colony on a broad strip of unsettled country already claimed by her, south of the Savannah River. It lay next to Florida, which then belonged to Spain and had been colonized by her. The Spaniards were at that time one of the most powerful and warlike nations in the world, and in their hearts they were very hostile to the English, although not openly at war with them. The Spanish soldiers were bold, skillful, and heartless, so much so that someone said of them, "A Spanish soldier is a machine of steel with the devil inside of it." Fortunately for Oglethorpe's enterprise, King George II of England was anxious to plant colonies in the unoccupied possessions south of the Savannah River as a protection for South Carolina against the bold and unscrupulous Spaniards of Florida. So he gladly granted to Oglethorpe, for the use of debtors and other poor persons, all the country between the Savannah and the Altamaha rivers, and as far westward as they might choose to go. This strip of country was named Georgia in honor of King George. A board of trustees consisting of 36 members, among whom were some of the most distinguished men in England, was appointed by the king to have entire charge of planting, establishing, and governing the new colony. They were to serve without pay or compensation of any sort. Let me repeat that. They were to serve without pay or compensation of any sort. It must be purely a labor of love with them. The good and great Lord Percival was president of the board, and Oglethorpe was one of the members. The trustees set about raising money to pay the cost of establishing the colony, for the poor people who were to go were not able to pay any part of their own expenses. Parliament made quite a liberal appropriation for the purpose, and a larger amount still was raised by public subscription from benevolent people in all parts of England. At one of the meetings of the trustees, it was suggested that some member of the board, a man of education and ability, should go over to America with the first colonists as their governor and live in Georgia with them until they were well and thoroughly established. Oglethorpe nobly volunteered to go, and the trustees were delighted. In undertaking this trying service, Oglethorpe would have to give up his luxurious home, the pleasures of refined society, and the splendid public career that was fast opening to him in England, and would have to endure untold hardships, privations, and dangers, and from it all, he had nothing, in a worldly sense, to gain for himself. The trustees had chosen as the official seal of the board a group of silkworms spinning their cocoons, and written underneath the noble motto, Non sibi sed alis, not for themselves, but for others. As those of you who have studied Latin know, the word sibi may also be correctly translated himself. The motto truly expressed the spirit of Oglethorpe in volunteering to go on this trying expedition. Non sibi sed alis, not for himself, but for others. Just a side note, interesting, let me interject here, that in our age we seem to only be able to see things through the eyes of profit. And when I looked at a current site, they interpreted this choice of motto as signifying and reflecting that they saw Georgia's role as a mercantile colony established to be the source of silk, not for their own benefit, but for England's. I'll let you judge for yourself if you think that's true. And now I'll continue. He was at this time 43 years old and was yet unmarried. So far as we know, he had never had a sweetheart. Perhaps he was so busy that he never had time to fall in love. When it was known that the great and good Oglethorpe himself would accompany the expedition, hundreds and hundreds of poor people, debtors and others, were anxious to go, but only a few could be taken. Out of the hundreds of applicants, the trustees carefully selected 40 strong, healthy men of good morals and with small families. Altogether, men, women, and children, the party consisted of 120 souls. More poor wretches who begged to go had to be turned away with tears in their eyes and bitter disappointment in their hearts. The good ship Anne, a sailing vessel of 200 tons burden, was chartered to take the immigrants across the ocean to America. In her hold, as she lay moored to the wharf at Gravesend, were stored provisions and all kinds of tools and implements for the journey and for getting the colony well established in Georgia. Everything was then ready for the voyage. I'll let you finish the story for yourself after I paint this little scene and draw out a couple of lessons. On the afternoon of February 12, 1733, they landed at the high bluff on the Savannah River. By sunset, they had spread under the tall pine trees 4 big white tents, and in these the whole colony, 120 souls, men, women, and children, were stored away as snug as a bug in a rug. Thus they spent their first night on Georgia soil. Oglethorpe, occupied by himself a little tent pitched under a group of 3 tall pine trees. Early the next morning, the colonists were assembled in front of Oglethorpe's tent for prayers. After prayers, Oglethorpe gave them a kind, fatherly talk and some good advice, and then they went about their work. For more than a year, Oglethorpe continued to live in this little tent under the 3 great pine trees overlooking the river, while he directed the work of the colonists, all of whose hardships and privations he shared. He laid off in the great forest the plan of the town that was to be builded there. That plan is perfectly preserved in the city of Savannah today. Of special interest to me was, again, as we have seen with William Penn and William Bradford, the peaceful relationship they had with the Native Americans. The story being told to our children today is that the white man, the settlers, worked nothing but death and destruction among the Indians. It's the danger of the single story again. There were white men who were savage and Indians who were peaceful, but there were also white men who were peaceful and Indians who were savage. But in several of these early stories, the white man and the native lived peacefully side by side. One of Oglethorpe's first order of business was to seek out 90-year-old Chief Tomachichi. Let me share that part of the story. On reaching the village, Oglethorpe called for Tomachichi, and he stepped forth like a king. He was not surprised to see the white men. He had often seen white people before. Oglethorpe told Tomachichi that he wished to settle with his colony in the woods nearby, but that they would not interfere in any way with the Yamacraws, that they would do no harm, but only good to the Indians. He hoped they might always be good friends and live as peaceful neighbors. Oglethorpe's noble countenance, kind manner, and fine promises completely won old Tomachichi's heart, and he said, "There is plenty of room here for both red men and white men. Bring your people onto our woods. As soon as they get settled, we will call to welcome them." But Tomachichi's tribe wasn't the only one occupying the area, and you'll want to read about the coming together of all these tribes in establishing peace. Picture 56 tribal leaders dressed in full native garb, not one of them is under 6 feet tall, gathered in one of Savannah's largest homes. It's an inspiring and unforgettable sight. Over and over, I see that where there was mutual respect and tolerance, there was peace. Sadly, that wasn't always the case, but here is one example to hold up to the light. Also of interest to me was that Tomachichi wanted to be taught about the Christian religion. When Oglethorpe returned to England for a short time, he brought back a young clergyman who served as his secretary for a time, a name you may recognize, John Wesley. Tomachichi was thrilled and said, "I'm glad you have come to speak the great word to us. I will do my best to get my people to listen to you as well. But we don't want to be made Christians as the Spaniards make them. They put water on an Indian's head and say, 'You are a Christian.' But we want you first to explain the great word to us so that we can understand it. Then we will be baptized and will be real Christians." But John Wesley, though a great and good man, was an utter failure as a missionary to these Native Americans. He lacked the power of winning their hearts and of teaching the great word in the simple way they needed. He explained the Christian religion to them in such a learned way that the poor Indians couldn't understand him. Tomachichi had deep religious instincts, but after a while lost all interest in the Christian religion. The reason came out one day when he was asked, "Tomachichi, why don't you become a Christian?" With flashing eye and scorn in his voice, the old man replied, "The people at Savannah are Christians. The people at Frederica are Christians. But they are no good. They get drunk. They tell lies. They fight. They beat weak people. They cheat poor Indians. Me, no Christian." Whoa. There's a lot of lessons in there for instilling faith in our own children, isn't there? Well, the story of the colony didn't end the way Oglethorpe had hoped, which you will find out. 2 laws were instituted, no rum and no slavery, which made the people angry and disgruntled, even after all he had done for them in rescuing them from their prisons. Here's the lesson I draw from that. We have become a people who are looking to our leaders to fix our problems. Here we have an example of exactly the kind of leader we would hope to have. One who was more interested in our welfare than our own. Someone who doesn't have that personal agenda. Who labors out of love. Who does all he can to make our lives better. Who is honest and fair in all his dealings, actions, and words. But the fact was, he was dealing with a people who weren't used to taking care of themselves. And despite the best of his intentions, he couldn't overcome that fact. While we ask which president is the best president our people can have, I say who are the best people a president can have. The children of Israel, like we in America, were given the great privilege of being self-governed under God. It was when they demanded and expected a king to fight their battles that they were weakened until they were eventually divided, scattered, and enslaved. I wrote a little book while I was serving on the executive board of Homemakers for America, that's now called Moms for America, called Restoring Our Garden of Liberty. I included a quote that has become a favorite of mine. It's from David Starr Jordan, the first president of Stanford University. If the experiment of government by the people is to be successful, it is you and such as you who must make it so. The future of the republic must lie in the hands of the men and women of culture and intelligence, of self-control and of self-resource, capable of taking care of themselves and of helping others. If it falls not into such hands, the republic will have no future. The problem of life is not to make life easier, but to make men stronger, so that no problem shall be beyond their solution. The remedy for oppression is to bring in better men who cannot be oppressed. So next time you want to throw your shoe through your computer or TV screen because of what you are seeing going on in the leadership of our country, remember, the real corrective work is taking place in your homes and in your families as you raise that generation of culture and intelligence, of self-control and self-resource capable of taking care of themselves and of helping others. The remedy for oppression is to bring in better men and women who cannot be oppressed. And then if we, at the same time, raise leaders like Henry Vane, William Penn, and James Oglethorpe, who labored for love, not personal gain, non sibi sed aliis, not for themselves but for others, what a beautiful world we will have. That is the dream and the vision of the well-educated heart. And the stories like these that you plant in the hearts of your children will help make that dream come true.